Hi, and welcome to The Horn, a podcast from the International Crisis Group. I'm Alan Boswell. Today, we're welcoming back to the show Alex DeWall. Alex is the Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, and he's here to speak with us about the looming famine in Sudan. Alex started his career as a scholar focused on previous famine in Darfur. Alex, thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be with you, though sadly another dismal topic to talk about.
So I want to start off by talking very much about the hunger situation in Sudan. Is there a famine yet in Sudan? And if not, how close are we?
There is what we might call a complex catastrophe involving hunger, breakdown of essential services, mass displacement, and indeed the breakdown of society that is going without doubt to kill hundreds of thousands of people, most of them children, over the coming months. So let's not get hung up on the term famine and whether the data are available for the Famine Review Committee of the Integrated Phase Classification System to determine beyond reasonable doubt that a certain number of people are in what they call IPC Phase 5, according to all the different criteria. Because of the informational vacuum, because of various other politics which we can get onto in Port Sudan, we may not see a famine declaration, but there's no question that the starvation crisis is on a scale without parallel for 40 years or more and is going to kill hundreds of thousands of Sudanese.
When you say without parallel, do you mean in all the world? We haven't seen a starvation crisis like this in several decades?
Without parallel in Sudan. When I first went to Sudan in 1984, we were in the middle of a terrible famine that claimed the lives of perhaps 250,000 people. If the worst case scenario plays out, which it may well do, and there's very little constraining that at the moment, we would face a mass mortality crisis, the likes of which we have not seen anywhere in the world, a hunger-related mass mortality crisis. We haven't seen anything like that for 40 or more years.
Okay. I've heard people say, at a minimum, it's going to be as bad as Somalia was over a decade ago, but that we're looking at possibly a famine like the world hasn't seen since Ethiopia in the 1980s. Is that sort of what you're seeing also?
That's absolutely correct. And I would say what a few things make this particular crisis unparalleled. One is that it covers the entire country of Sudan. The worst hit areas are in Darfur and other RSF-controlled areas around Khartoum and Jazeera. But the entire country is in food crisis or food emergency. Most of the neighboring countries are too: Chad, Central African Republic, South Sudan, much of Ethiopia, and Libya and Egypt are not very conducive for refugees these days. So there's nowhere to go, and there are no regional buffers to absorb people, providing them with employment. There isn't much in the way of pre-positioned food stocks or harvests in next-door countries. So this is really a crisis of a scale that is without parallel.
Mm. And so you mentioned briefly that it matters less whether or not the IPC and the Famine Review Board declare famine. But if this is this bad, how has that system broken down? Because obviously it would seem like that system would be designed to catch a crisis, a catastrophe like this early and, you know, make sure the world responds. So what's breaking down in that system?
Well, the two international famine prevention mechanisms, the IPC and FUSNET, have been warning for over a year that this is coming. They've not broken down. They've been saying this crisis will happen unless something is done to stop it. So the warnings have been there. We shouldn't blame those systems because they have done their job. No one has been listening, or no one has been acting if they have been listening. Now, the particular problem that the IPC faces has two parts. The first is that it relies upon data. And where there are no good data, it is very hesitant to infer from poor quality data to worst case scenarios. So there's a lack of data because so many of the humanitarians left Sudan when the war broke out. And relatedly, for the Famine Review Committee to be convened, something called the Technical Working Group of the IPC has to reach consensus that famine is likely. Now, the problem here is that the UN-recognized government, the Sudan Armed Forces, SAF, sit on that. The UN last year having decided to recognize the government of General Al-Burhan, essentially handed it a veto over the decisions of the technical working group. So even if the humanitarians agree, SAF is in a position to block that. And it wants to block it because it doesn't want a formal famine declaration, because that will put it under pressure to allow humanitarian access, which it doesn't want to do.
Is that not a flaw in the famine declaration system, that a government can block a famine declaration inside their own country?
It's a flaw. We saw that flaw in Ethiopia. We've seen that flaw in South Sudan, and we're seeing it today in Sudan. And it's a flaw that needs to be fixed.
Okay. So you mentioned that there are several causes, obviously the war, but then related causes, including the scale of hunger in the surrounding region as well. But what specifically, was it the destruction of crops by RSF? Is it mostly the displacement, the stopping of agriculture, or the fact that the humanitarian aid system has basically broken down over the past year? What's the prime drivers of such mass hunger inside Sudan?
Well, let's call this a complex catastrophe because it has many drivers that have accumulated over the years. They're layers. You have a desperately dysfunctional national food system at the best of times. Large-scale commercial sorghum agriculture, large-scale wheat imports, which are inherently very costly, and that system is probably not sustainable. You have the legacy of previous wars in Darfur, in the Nuba Mountains, and large numbers of people who are displaced and reliant on food aid, and so on. You have all these layers. And then on top of that, you get the several things going on, the mass displacement and the destruction of essential infrastructure and services that began at scale with the war when it broke out 14 months ago. You have the fact that the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, essentially operate like a pillage machine, like a swarm of locusts, looting every village, every town, every city where they go, and going beyond looting, actually vandalizing hospitals, agricultural equipment that they can't loot, which serves no real purpose other than wanton destruction. And then on top of that, you have the fact that the SAF is not permitting humanitarian access. It's only just begun to allow aid into the areas that it controls, but it is still taking an extremely hard line on the worst hit areas, which are under the control of the RSF. So in their different ways, the two principal belligerents are each using starvation as a weapon of war.
Mm. And why exactly is Port Sudan, in your estimation, blocking food aid into RSF-held areas? What do they hope to gain, do you think, from doing that?
I think it's extremely transparent here. They're not making any bones about it. They've not been doing well in the war. They cannot defeat the RSF on the battlefield. They can make the occasional tactical victory, but they cannot roll them back. And so as they contemplate the weapons in their arsenal, the cheapest and most effective one is starvation. And when you look at the history of Sudan, and when they look at the history of Sudan, more importantly, their view is that back in 1989, when their older comrades in the Sudan army, when they permitted aid into South Sudan, at that time the Sudan People's Liberation Army was fighting a war in South Sudan, and they permitted the United Nations to launch Operation Lifeline Sudan in 1989. And that allowed aid to go in, which fed a lot of civilians. It also supported, in their view, the SPLA. And more, even more importantly, the aid workers who went in became sympathetic to the SPLA. And so, as it were, the humanitarian nose of the camel got into the tent, and then the body followed. And the body was the legitimation of the SPLA and ultimately the independence of South Sudan. And they don't want to repeat that mistake. They are quite explicit about that. And I think there are quite a few diplomats, United Nations, Europeans, US diplomats, who think that somehow they will be able to persuade General Burhan and his cabal of generals to relent, to follow the 1989 precedent of OLS. And I think they're deluding themselves. This is an absolutely existential war for SAF, as it is for the RSF. And the only truly effective weapon that SAF has is starvation, and they're not going to give it up easily.
Mm. Before we move on to what the options are, just on this question of Operation Lifeline Sudan, I've had senior aid officials, you know, point to the fact that Hemeti started tweeting about the need for a Operation Lifeline Sudan-like operation in early February, right before Port Sudan basically rescinded the permission for the UN to do this cross-border aid. And plenty think that that was a trigger for Port Sudan stopping, allowing the UN to do this cross-border aid that they were doing there for a while. Are there any lessons on the humanitarian side about OLS? Is there a way to do a large-scale aid delivery in a crisis like this that doesn't fall into some of those other moral hazards, or not really?
If this aid operation had been started, let's say, a year ago, before the crisis descended to this level, all the types of operational field procedures that the UN has would have been effective. This crisis could have been prevented. And it could have been prevented in such a way that the political fallout and repercussions would have been minimized. Famine and famine relief are always political. Famine is not just an aggregate of people going hungry and dying. It is a societal trauma and transformation. And it is a nationwide famine of this nature will leave a generations-long imprint on Sudan, on the way, on its political economy, its social structures, its national identity. And when it gets to this stage, there are simply no good options. And if the diplomats who are negotiating with the generals and indeed with Hemeti to try and stand up some sort of operation think that they are able to make an appeal to goodwill, an appeal to, you know, humanitarian sentiment and stabilize the situation in without having major political ramifications, they're wrong. The humanitarian and the political are now intrinsically intertwined. And there is a major moral judgment that all have to make, which is to what extent those who care about saving lives, keeping intact some form of functioning society, are ready to intervene and face the political consequences, whatever they may be.
And so what really are the options at this point? As you mentioned, the UN recognizes the Port Sudan government and the World Food Program says it's not able to do large-scale cross-border aid relief without the permission of Port Sudan. There have been some convoys in recent weeks that have gotten across, but nothing like a large-scale operation that would be needed. So what actually should the humanitarian system be doing?
It's desperately late. There are many things that could have been done months ago, including actually pre-positioning stocks in neighboring countries, having a famine prevention action plan. None of this has been done. And in due course, I hope that there will be an assessment and those responsible for inaction will be called to account. For now, some of those actions can still be taken in a remedial way. The responsibility for humanitarian action can be taken out of Port Sudan, can be positioned in the region with hubs in South Sudan, which is facing its own extremely serious humanitarian crisis in Chad and possibly elsewhere as well. But the major action requires political action and political leverage on the principal belligerents. And the United States has lost that material leverage because the key players here are the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And while Riyadh and Abu Dhabi are not talking to each other, and in fact are just seeking to cancel each other's initiatives out, the current situation will continue. And there is little material leverage on them. But there is perhaps a reputational leverage to recognize, make them recognize that the deaths of hundreds of thousands or maybe even millions of Sudanese will be on their conscience, on their record, should they not take the political action that is needed to stop it right away.
In some ways, the fact that aid is not able to get in Darfur seems hard for people to accept because the Port Sudan government only has a legal veto of sorts. It can't actually physically block aid from entering Darfur because it doesn't control hardly any of the border. So are there really no other options other than a large-scale World Food Program effort? Is there no other way to get relief into Darfur at scale?
There are a number of mechanisms, and really at this stage, all the taps need to be turned on. There is no sense in prioritizing one over the other. So one of the mechanisms that can be used is the emergency response rooms, the local committees that are extremely effective in their locations at delivering assistance and protection. There are not many of them in Darfur, but there are some. They are more active elsewhere in the country. And the international donors have been deplorably slow and bureaucratic in unlocking the resources necessary for the ERRs to function at scale. There are also local NGOs. There's the option of airlifts into areas that are controlled by neither SAF nor the RSF, such as Jebel Mara, controlled by Abdul Wahid al-Nur. And there are more than a million desperately hungry, displaced people taking shelter in his region. Also in South Kordofan, similarly, there are enormous humanitarian needs that can be met. The other thing that can be done, and the mechanisms are known and tested, they're not perfect, but they should be tried, which is using the commercial sector. Providing money or vouchers that can be redeemed against food purchases, and getting Sudan's truckers, commercial truckers, who are extremely capable and adept at operating in very complex and hazardous situations, getting them to transport the food. But food would also therefore need to be brought into neighboring countries, and the humanitarian crises in those countries would also need to be addressed.
Who's capable of leading on those? Does it need to be WFP and the UN? Is the US capable of doing it? Who could step in with a large-scale emergency response right now?
The obvious candidates here are the United States and the UN, the World Food Programme. But others could also assist. And I think we should look to Middle Eastern states, the Gulf countries that have enormous logistical capabilities that they have not used at all, as well as their very considerable political weight.
So stepping back a bit into the war in Sudan more generally, how do you characterize the civil war, the collapse state in Sudan? You know, you are a scholar very much on Sudanese history, as well as famine. Do you find any historical precedent for what's happening now? How do you frame the current war and collapse of Sudan?
So there's no historical precedent in the last 100 years. But if we go back longer, we see that actually the sort of political economic models that are emerging in Sudan are rather horribly familiar. So in the 19th century, the process that actually created the geographical Sudan, and indeed the state of Sudan in its prototypical form, was a sort of transnational imperial plunder enterprise. in which a coalition of some northern Sudanese adventurers, merchants, and soldiers with Egyptians, with European and Middle Eastern mercenaries and others, set about establishing transnational, quasi-commercial, quasi-mercenary enterprises to plunder the Sudanese territory as a whole, but especially its peripheries in the south and the west, disregarding the borders, going into what is now Central African Republic, Chad, Congo, even as far as northern Nigeria. And it's that model of a sort of plunder-based transnational entity run for partly for profit, partly for power, that is re-emerging. And Hemeti is an exemplar of that. But also there are parts of SAF that resemble that too. So we shouldn't be thinking of what is happening in terms of state collapse as a sort of an historical aberration, and somehow Sudan will get back to what we consider a normal standard path of state building around a set of state institutions, a monopoly over the control of violence, etc. We'd all love to see that. But actually, it's much more likely that the future will resemble the more distant past, where insofar as they are state, there are internationally recognized states, they are wholly owned subsidiaries of transnational mercenary enterprises.
Mm. And if you did manage to get a ceasefire in Sudan, realistically speaking, what would Sudan look like moving ahead as a country?
So I think we're seeing a de facto fragmentation of Sudan into different zones. And one tends to talk about two zones, east and west of the Nile, but we shouldn't forget the way the Nuba Mountains are essentially an autonomous quasi-republic at the moment. Jebel Mara under Abdel Wahid is also similar. And indeed, it's quite possible that we would see both RSF and SAF fragmenting into different fiefdoms. I'm actually surprised that that hasn't happened up to now, that they've managed to retain the coherence of centralized command and control that they have up to now. So I think, I hope there will be a ceasefire. I hope that that will provide the foundation for a major humanitarian operation, for the restoration of essential services, and for the growth of civic initiatives across all of Sudan. I fear that we're a long way away from establishing anything that resembles the what we would like to consider a normal state.
Mm. And there have obviously been numerous initiatives at various points to try to end the war, although arguably none of them have been very serious. What's been missing from the response to the war, you know, a serious response to the war to try to end it thus far?
I think for nobody in the regional or international arena has resolving the conflict in Sudan been a sufficient priority. What every single actor has been seeking to do is, first of all, to position themselves with regard to their regional rivals. So the Jeddah peace process has for a year been entirely hostage to the rivalry between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi. And that's killed it. It's frankly, let's say it outright, Jeddah is dead. It's going nowhere. The African Union wants desperately to be relevant, but it hasn't got the political strategy, let alone the implementation mechanisms for actually making good on its aspirations. Countries such as Egypt and Kenya have all had initiatives, but they've cancelled each other out. Though I would say the Egyptians are probably being more helpful now than they have been at any other time. And the United Nations essentially surrendered any leadership role that it might play to regional organizations and therefore has not been relevant up to now. Though hopefully the UN Security Council will be taking a lead. And the United States has rendered itself largely irrelevant, because the issue has to be handled at the White House or Secretary of State level, because the keys to resolving Sudan are in the Middle East, not in Africa. And while it remains an African file, it simply won't be resolved out of Washington.
You mentioned earlier, and you wrote also in the foreign affairs piece on Sudan's upcoming famine, which we'll link to for the audience in the show notes. But you mentioned that the ultimate leverage over these two rests in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, with MBS and MBZ. Should we be thinking of Sudan now as basically a satellite of the Gulf? And when did this happen?
I think that's exactly right. I think that we should see the entire Horn of Africa as the strategic perimeter of the Gulf, as the area in which the BRICS Plus, which its new members are all within the Red Sea arena, have, as it were, put their stamp. They've said, this is the part of the world where the BRICS Plus are setting the strategic agenda. And therefore, approaches to Sudan need to be channeled through that analytical and policy lens.
And in terms of the low priority of the response, I'm curious how much of this you chalk up to a framework for responding to crises in this part of Africa, which, you know, was very U.S.-centered to a degree, U.N.-centered, African Union and IGAD-centered. And now we're in this era in which Sudan especially looks very much like the leverage is across the Red Sea. In the Gulf, and you do have a number of other actors who are involved as well. Is it just almost an inevitable byproduct that trying to resolve crises like Sudan, you know, in this new world will just be very difficult? Taking a step back, are there any better ways to do this besides just higher level prioritization? Obviously, countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE view conflicts differently than Western countries do.
I think the United Nations has a leadership role here that it has signally failed to take. Because the UN, the Secretary General, and then following that, the Security Council could have convened all the stakeholders and could have essentially made the case, everyone here has their favorite rider in this race, this political race in Sudan, that is. But we all know that if the race is run, then all the horses will fall. Sudan will actually be a calamity. Let us agree in a multilateral forum some ground rules for how our political rivalries are conducted in such a way that it does not involve complex catastrophes that kill hundreds of thousands or millions of people and render states entirely unviable. If the UN were to set such an agenda, I think there would be common ground between the Western-leaning countries, and especially the United States, and the rising middle powers in the Middle East, and indeed the countries of the BRICS. I'm sure that China would not be averse to such an approach.
So, final question. You know, the origins of this war go back in some ways to what was a botched and failed transition from the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir. You know, this is a war between Bashir's leftover armies, so to speak, and coup-proofing gone wrong in a way. You wrote in the London Review of Books right after this, right after this war broke out, you called this the revolution that no one wanted. And I believe you had a phrase in there that said, a lot of the time since Bashir fell, you've bitten your tongue because of how bad things in Sudan could have gotten. What did you bite your tongue about? What went so wrong in that transition?
I think a couple of things went wrong. I think the civilians underestimated the importance of dealing with the military kleptocracy. They got preoccupied with what were frankly irrelevant, superficial issues around constitutional issues, which became irrelevant because real power did not lie there. And they failed properly to engage with the fundamental economic issue. Democracy in Sudan would only be viable if the economy were viable. And the Trump administration had decided that it was not going to take any serious step to make Sudan viable until it got something in return. And what it got in return was Sudan joining the Abraham Accords. And that happened way too late and in a manner that only in empowered the soldiers. So the civilians, in my view, were pretty naive, and they paid the price for that.
Thanks, Alex, as always, for your time and insights.
You're very welcome.
The Horn is a production of the International Crisis Group. If you want to read more on our work on Sudan, we've just published a briefing about the horrific situation in Darfur. You can read it at crisisgroup.org, and we'll link it to the show notes. We'll also link to Alex's recent article in Foreign Affairs. Once again, I'm Alan Boswell. Our producers are Mae Francis and Ida Holly-Nambi.